I'm Gary Hayes, and I'm interviewing Dr. William Badger at his home in Sun Lakes, Arizona, on June 2nd, 2000, at 10:05 a.m. Dr. Badger, could you please say what your years of service were and what rank were you retired?
I spent 26 years and some months, and I retired as a full colonel in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
And what was your service in Vietnam, from what time and with what unit?
I went over to Vietnam with the 14th Engineer Battalion. I was the S3, or the operations officer, and it was in the fall of 1966, and I think I came home a year later in the September time frame of 1967.
And you went over with the battalion as a whole unit. It was not something you joined
against. Yes, I was the S3 of a combat engineer battalion stationed at Fort Bragg, and we got notice that the whole unit would be deployed, and so for over about a 6 month period, we got in the officer complement of the new recruits from basic training and schools, and we formed the battalion up for service in Vietnam, and so we had 6 months of extensive training getting ready for Vietnam, and then the whole battalion moved to the Cam Ranh Bay area in Vietnam.
As the S3, you were responsible for training, right?
Yes, as the S3, you take all the planning for what each company is going to do, and of course we would study what other battalions were doing getting ready to go to Vietnam, and so we had a pretty extensive training plan. We would train at Fort Bragg, then we would go to the field and have field training. But everyone was learning how to communicate, to move around, to use the equipment, to set up, to eat and sleep in the field, to do the things that soldiers do. Fire all the weapons, get qualified on everything. So we had 6 good months of training.
Was the training that you conducted at Fort Bragg, was that indicative of what you actually did?
Well, I think what happens in country Vietnam is that they want you to do more building of roads, bridges, buildings, and stuff. And in our training, we learn how to use the equipment and we learn how to build, but we were a combat engineer battalion, and so we probably train more on supporting things in combat engineering like mines and support to infantry units. When we got to Vietnam, our focus was in construction, and so we had a more of a construction focus than a combat engineer focus. And right away, the challenge was that when we're building a tropical city with two-story buildings, as we started doing things that weren't in our experience or capabilities, like we had to do all the wiring and we didn't have electricians, so we had to go back and find out who in the battalion had any experience pulling wire and doing electrical things. It was the same with plumbing. We were combat engineers, but all of a sudden we're putting plumbing in and the water systems, and all of a sudden we had to find out if we had anybody experienced as a plumber, and we found those people within the battalion. But we had more of a construction focus than a combat engineer focus.
And when you got to Vietnam, what was your first impression?
Well, I flew over with a 30-person advance party, the colonel, the S3, and a number of people in our equipment. And we landed at Cam Ranh Bay after about 8 days on this C-130 airplane. So it's a long, hard travel to get there, but you get there and the first thing is hot. You're getting into an area that you don't know. You land there and somebody's meeting you, and all of a sudden you're moved up to Vung Ro Bay where the battalion's going to come in, and you're put in tents and you're going to meetings with people that have experience and been in Vietnam, and obviously you're the new person on the block and that big unknown. So there is a transformation type period where you have to figure out who the players are and what the rules of engagement are and what's going on. And it's always difficult to move into the unknown.
1966 was fairly early in the conflict, so you were one of the first heavy or engineer battalions over there?
No, no, there was a number there before us, but we moved in during the build-up in 66, and that was when I thought the war was looked on in a more favorable impression by everyone, and we moved into Vietnam, and we were with American troops, and we were doing things that American units knew how to do, and so we were working on building the infrastructure. I think that the shortage of equipment and supplies in country was such that things were building up, and so maybe if you had to pick a period of time when it was best to serve in Vietnam, I always thought that the 1966-67 was the best time to be there.
And since you did go in country as a unit, how did that work as a rotation process?
Well, it obviously, when our battalion got there, we had probably the healthiest, better trained soldiers and young officers. We had all new equipment and that hadn't been used or damaged, and so automatically there was a system of rotating soldiers and sergeants and officers out of our battalion into other units, and so there was a plan where we would lose one quarter of all our people each 3 months, so that at the end of a year that the 14th would be no longer available. So what happens is they keep moving new people in and taking your people. So you become a replacement type battalion, which means constant turmoil. It's kind of bad when you train your people and you all have new equipment, and then you have to give away your new equipment and get old equipment or no equipment. So there's that adaptation that a new unit has to go through. I served 6 months as the S3, and then I moved to Cameron Bay to be the engineer for a group, and a new S3 came in from the States. Well, then his year would project over that time after 12 months when the battalion arrived in country. And so there was a plan, and it was painful, but it had to be done.
As the S3, weren't you responsible for the unit readiness and the equipment, and how did that affect you with the process and plan that was put in place as to change every 3 months?
Well, what happens is you know what you have when you arrive, and then as people are moving old new equipment out of the battalion and putting new in, you constantly had to keep up with what was operational, because usually on a nightly basis was responsible for moving engineer equipment around to where it was needed. And you have four companies building things, and maybe you have 15 or 20 projects going on. Every project requires different equipment during the phases of the project. So we were efficiently moving the equipment, trying to level requirements. And as stuff would break down, it would go into maintenance. So it become a matter of control. It become a matter of figuring out the right mix of what job requires what equipment, and be sure that it's there on time and ready to go to work.
Sounds like it probably kept you very busy. What was your daily routine like while you were there at the S3?
You get up at daylight, obviously, and working in the operations center, that was kind of the hub of all communications. And as every problem or difficulty would come up at a project or within the company, they would come through and you were changing or moving or sending them things to keep things going. So there was an operational aspect, which is kind of the center of the communications. You can't have jobs, construction jobs, projects, without visiting them. And if the S3 doesn't know what's going on the ground, then you won't make good decisions. So there was always a case of getting the Jeep and you and your driver visiting projects. Always a challenge of staying in communications while you're checking the projects. Usually every night there was a operations meeting where everybody comes in and told everybody the good things and the bad things going on, and asking for equipment or support. So you wound up working an 18-hour day. Usually I was in bed before midnight. I usually got up at 6. So you wound up getting a 6-hour of sleep a day. But we worked 7 days a week. After a while, we started programming where we would get one afternoon a week off. And usually you would sleep or go swimming.
What was the living conditions? You were a field grade officer, so I'm assuming that you probably had better living conditions than some of the enlisted.
I went into country as a captain S3, and so my whole year as the S3 of the 14th Engineer Battalion in Fort Bragg, I was a captain in a major's position. And my 6 months as the S3 in country, I was a captain in a major's position. So even though I was the third ranking officer in the battalion, we had one lieutenant colonel, one major. I was a captain, but basically I slept with the officers that worked for me, the S2, the engineer officers from the headquarters company. So a group of a dozen or so officers slept in one tent, and I had a corner of the tent and a bunk. But we all wore the same clothes. We all ate the same mess hall, the 10-in-1 C rations. I don't think the officers were treated much different than the men. You know, I had my own Jeep. So being a field grade officer in combat, I think is not much different than being a soldier in combat.
When you said after 6 months you became the engineer at Cameron Bay, what was your duties there?
The 45th Engineer Construction Group was stationed at Cameron Bay and supervised battalions, and the 14th was one of those battalions. And the 14th Combat Engineer Battalion was across the bay at Bamitu, I think was the name. No, it was Don Bethen. But then when I moved to group, we had battalions, I think two battalions at Cameron Bay. In my engineering section, I was basically the engineer for Cameron Bay. We had a number of challenging projects that we designed ourselves. And I had a three or four young engineer officers, lieutenants and captains, and they would do the design. But basically, stuff like how to handle the sewage problem at Cameron Bay. You had Navy, Air Force, and Army. And back in those days, when you had probably 50,000 people on Cameron Bay, there's a lot of waste that these people generate. The Air Force, in their wisdom, decided that they would collect their waste and run it out through a pipe out into the bay and pollute the water. The Navy decided they would build their latrines and use tile fields and pollute the land. The Army, in their wisdom, decided that we would put our waste in 55-gallon drums cut off, and that we'd put diesel in it and we'd burn it each night. So the Army was polluting the air, the Navy was polluting the sand of the land, and the Air Force was polluting the water. So we had a number of meetings that I attended on how we're going to handle the sewage disposal problem at Cameron Bay. I don't think we ever solved it. We tried to take care of it the best we could. The other engineering challenge at Cameron Bay was being on sand. The first people come in did not do drainage ditches and drainage, because anytime it would rain, the sand would soak up the rain. Well, soldiers being soldiers in all these tent base camps, they would go across and bring in the laterite, which is a type of clay, and they would put this laterite on the road and smooth it out, so the roads become hard, and then when it rained, the water ran off and didn't infiltrate into the sand. So initially, they didn't need ditches. Later on, when they had their buildings and tents and everything in, and the laterite on the road, all of a sudden they needed runoff. And so one solution that we had was that we V-shaped the road, and the middle of the road become a ditch, and the water could run down the middle of the road and run off. So drainage was a big item, and on the few paved roads we have, when it would rain, the water would run off and wash out the culverts because they wouldn't be big enough, or wash out the roads. So you're always worried about keeping the road net open, keeping a viable place for people to live, taking care of the waste that they generated. So there's always a challenge for an engineer.
Getting back to also with 14th, then when she, the engineer, Cameron Bay, he must have done a lot of traveling around the areas. Did you have any interesting or humorous experiences while you were traveling around?
At the time, humorous is not a good word. Probably being in helicopters was the greatest concern of all engineer officers. I don't know the statistics, but I imagine more engineer officers were killed in helicopter crashes than any other way of getting killed in Vietnam. So anytime you would fly in helicopters, that was always a concern. I think that probably the two stories that stand out was I just made major, and I was flying to check a project out when I was in the engineer for Cameron Bay. We were over Praling Mountain. Of course, when you're in the back of a helicopter, you're, as a passenger, you're kind of dozing or sleeping, not paying attention. All of a sudden, the hydraulics on this helicopter went out, and the helicopter went into one of these auto rotations where the free swing of the prop around the plane creates a lift, but the plane really drops very fast, and so the pilot found a spot on Praline Mountain to put the helicopter down. I can remember the whole time going down, the airplane's dropping so fast that it's pulling you up against your seatbelt. And so I spent the whole time going down trying to get my butt back in the seat. And then when I hit, you spend all your time trying to get your butt out of the seat. You always worry about when you hit whether something's going to burn. So as soon as you hit the ground, you jump out. Actually, even though we hit pretty hard, we had the runners, and the helicopter wasn't damaged. But I remember as the young captain pilot jumped out and turned to me and saluted and says, "Major, you're now in charge." And I thought, one minute I'm a passenger and I'm daydreaming, and the next minute I'm in charge of half a dozen people with a helicopter on Praline Mountain. And so I can remember telling the machine gunners to deploy their machine guns out on a couple of locations and getting the pilot on the radio to try to radio back and get help. We figured out what parts we needed and radioed back for those parts. And within 2 hours, a helicopter flew out. Our helicopter was fixed, and we flew off the mountain back in that same helicopter. So I guess that was the one story. Another one was, I can remember that we had some rather wild young officers woke me up one Sunday morning and asked me if I wanted to go with them. And I said, "Well, where are you going?" And they said, "We're going to go helicopter riding out over the Cameron Bay, and we're going to take machine guns, and we're going to go out and shoot sharks." And I told them to get the hell out of my bedroom. I says, "The first thing is I'm not going to go for a helicopter ride unless I have to. And two, I'm not going to go out there and make sharks mad in case that helicopter crashes in the sea with a bunch of mad sharks." But I tried not to do those foolish things that a lot of young people would do.
So you said you didn't like riding helicopters. Did you feel the equipment that you had, that the Army provided for you, the personal equipment as well as the helicopters and the other things that you had to use, your jeeps, was it of good quality? Was it standard, substandard, or was it okay?
No, I thought the engineer equipment that we trained on at Fort Bragg and that we took to Vietnam was excellent. It was maintained well. I think the helicopters were fine. I think there was a real learning curve. If you fly real close to the ground in helicopters, you're better off than flying up about 1,800 feet. You don't want to fly in that dead zone there where people can shoot at you. You never know when somebody's going to be shooting at you. So you either fly high or you fly low. But I think maybe this was the first war where helicopters was used in great numbers. And probably we had a lot to learn about helicopters. But no, I thought we had good equipment. I didn't see anything wrong with the equipment.
On a more personal level, you were a career Army officer, so this was normal for you. But how did your family and your wife deal with the separation and you going to war?
Well, I came in the Army in 59, and so the Korean War was over. And as an engineering officer, we knew that we would have one, two, or three short tours in our career where we'd be without family for a year. And so, as I wanted to have a good career plan, and I wanted to do well, and I made captain in my fourth year, and wound up being the engineer officer on the island of Komoi Matsu, where the offshore islands off of Formosa and the National Chinese were firing at us on the odd day. So being the engineer officer at Komoi was a good tour, and it helped my career. But I came back in my sixth year, and I didn't have what I thought enough company command time, so I asked for a combat engineer battalion and went to Fort Bragg. When I got in the battalion here, I'm a captain with 6-7 year service, and I was the third ranking officer in the battalion, so I didn't get the company because a lot of the companies were commanded by lieutenants. So I wound up the S3. Kind of making major in my eighth year, the Vietnam War, things were accelerated and moving on. But I kind of looked at going to Vietnam as a career opportunity, but I looked at it as kind of the things that one should do. If you're a professional officer and you take the King's Silver, obviously you got to do the King's Do or something like that. But, I didn't look at it. I thought it was the thing I was supposed to do, and I think as we thought of the war in 1966, stopping the spread of communism or slowing it down was the right thing to do. That this helped, I thought, the stability of the world at that time. I guess in my heart, I still feel that by slowing down the spread of communism over time, that maybe we had stopped the advent of World War III. So, I think being a professional soldier, this is what you do, and this is what you're expected to do, and I think the family understood that, and I think it was accepted.
So did you and your wife communicate on a regular basis, or?
Yes. If you wait a week to write, then and you wait for a significant event to write about, you wait another week, and then you're not communicating. So Janie and I decided that we would write every day. So I wrote every day, and she wrote every day. Now the mails would maybe not come in, and maybe the letters were only one page long. But the letters from home is always about the kids. When I went to Vietnam, I left Janie with two, a boy and a girl, in diapers. And this is probably the hardship is on the wife, not on the husband. I think when husbands go off to war, there's a certain amount of adventure, and I thought it was very interesting, and I did more engineering and soldiering in my year in Vietnam than you would do 3 or 4 years in peacetime. So I thought it was a heck of a learning experience, and I rather enjoyed it. And maybe like old General Lee says, if war wasn't so tragic and people didn't get killed, that how much fun it would be. So my tour in Vietnam was a positive year, and I think of it in positive terms.
Now, did your wife and you write letters daily when you were in China as well, or is that something?
Oh yeah, we did the same thing in China. It's not like email of today or communication where you can get on the phone. I can imagine if we were in Vietnam today, every soldier would have a cell phone and be talking home every night. Back then, the communications was more difficult, but the letters home every day, I think that's an important link with the family.
Do you sometimes have regrets that you were a career Army officer, so you had to do these things, but do you think that you missed out a lot when you were gone for a year at a time on what your kids were when they were growing up and that kind of stuff?
I've thought about that, and I think what happens is when you go through a separation or you're away from the family, it makes you miss them, and so when you're home, you make up for it. And I think you do better once you're home. So I think maybe in total that it doesn't have the adverse impact that a lot of people would like to say it does. And I know that the kids, I had three short tours, the China Quemoy one, the Vietnam one, and then a year in Saudi Arabia when I went by myself. It was very career enhancing to me. But I think the family survived just well, and I don't think it adversely affected any of the kids or the relationship with my wife and I. If you look at certain civilian careers in the U.S., airline pilots or other type, where people may be sleeping away from home half their time each year, or you look at people that are working in industry that are very successful and take a lot of business trips, probably in my 26-year career, my average time away from home probably would be no more than other civilian professors where you're going to be a professional. So, you know, I think that's probably overstated.
And again, you spent 26 years, so you were not the typical or stereotype that we think of soldiers who served in Vietnam. You were a field grade officer, you were a career Army officer. Was there a problem, especially when you were in 14, with the draftees, with the freshly minted second lieutenants that didn't want to be there? Did you have any problems with that?
I cannot remember, out of the 40 officers or the enlisted people, any person that had any sentiment like that. All the 800 or so enlisted, the sergeants, we all thought we were doing the right thing. We all were professional, and we all. And so I think what happens is until the liberal press, or whatever you want to call the press, starts making issues and starts shaping people's attitude towards things. I think at the time in '66 when we went over there, we thought we were doing the right thing. And I didn't sense any resentment or any feeling. In fact, I think our year in Vietnam, there was only four court-martials, and they were of minor things. There wasn't a drug problem. There wasn't a discipline problem. I can remember getting ready to go to Vietnam. There was very little discipline problem. Their threat of going to Vietnam, everybody knew that training was important, and so they jumped right into training. So I am probably one of those people that my Vietnam getting ready to go training time and in-country time was, I saw a lot of positive things, very few negative things.
I would assume, and you probably helped me out on this one, but four court-martials for an entire year for battalion, is that would probably be a much higher number if you were back at Fort Bragg.
Oh, absolutely. I think that someone statistically sat down and figured out if we had stayed at Fort Bragg, statistically, drinking and driving, we would probably have lost, through accidents, six of our soldiers. The year we were in Vietnam, we had a number of people wounded, but we only had two soldiers killed. One was accidentally shot off the back of a truck, and another... a soldier went out in Cameron Bay swimming on his day off and drowned. So we lost two people out of 820 during that year. And if the unit would have been at Fort Bragg on normal peacetime service, you could make the argument that they'd have lost six. So the soldiers in the 14th Engineer Battalion for 66 to 67 was safer and better off in Vietnam. Now, that's stretching it and misusing statistics. But I think that's, in Vietnam, we were taking care of our soldiers.
Now, what do you think, that was a command climate that caused that?
I think that was a large part of it. We had a battalion commander that was great in a number of ways. He was a Christian man. He says that the officers and men won't overdrink. They won't take advantage of the Vietnamese women. And we will play the rules the way they were written. That was his positive side. Negatively, I thought he was a minutia manager, but he was a good colonel. And our battalion did not carouse around at night. When we did our convoys, all the trucks were lined up, Every truck was sandbagged. Every soldier had their flak vest on. Everybody wore their helmet. Every weapon was tested before we'd go out. And we were always well prepared. And the VC, being all around you, is aware of which units do the right thing, always well prepared. And our year in Vietnam, our compound wasn't hit, or any of our convoys hit. And we had units all around us hit, and we had convoys all around us hit. But I think being well prepared and well trained really took care of the 14th Engineer Battalion, and that goes back to the positive leadership of the people that ran the battalion. If you have good leadership and you do what's right, that's your best chance of staying alive.
Did any of your units, while they were doing their missions, doing their engineering or construction work, they ever had receive any fire?
Yeah, we were fired on, and the things that there's certain areas that are more dangerous than others. If you have a rock crushing facility and it's very isolated, those isolated units are always subject to you know, concern. If you put a water purification crew out, there are usually two or three people out by themselves. So I think that you always worry, and these people would get some fire. So we knew that, and so we were very careful to try to keep our outlying areas with a critical mass of people so that it didn't look like an inviting target. And I think the VC had enough inviting targets around from other units that they didn't hit our folks because we weren't an inviting target. And there again, that was good planning on our part.
Well, that's the S3. That was your job.
Well, but at the time, you know, you could claim that we lacked imagination by you do everything by the book. But we were very methodical and very pragmatic. And in retrospect, that was a good philosophy. You just go over and do what you're supposed to do. I think that if you stay within your capability, then you don't get overextended.
What was your feeling or your impressions of the Vietnamese people?
The Vietnamese people I saw were always friendly and nice and obviously caught in the middle of everything. You know, your one rule of thumb, you smile and wave at people, and if they smile and wave back, they're friendly Vietnamese people. If they shoot at you, then they're VC. But I'm afraid that we had no way of knowing who were VC and who were not VC. And so I have a feeling that the people were probably the victims because they were getting used by both sides.
Did you have any dealings with the South Vietnamese Army?
No, we really didn't see the Army. I only visited Saigon one time for a conference a couple of days. And I remember going down to Saigon, and they had a policy. They wanted you to turn your weapon in while you're in the city. And after you live and wear your weapon every day, day and night, to give somebody else your weapon, you kind of feel naked. And I guess I kind of understand how the cowboys felt when they went to Dodge City and Wyatt Earp or whoever it was took their pistol away from them. But I can remember putting my pistol in my briefcase and not turning it in because you get so dependent on always having your pistol. But we really never saw the Vietnamese Army very much. And we dealt with American units, and we had a clear mission and job, and we did it. So it was not a political type war for us. It would just go out and build things and do our job.
So do you think comparing Saigon to Cam Ranh Bay, was there a difference in the people? Was there a difference in the climate?
Well, I thought that Cam Ranh Bay was obviously more like a resort on the beach there. Saigon was the big city with a lot of things going on. It's hard to compare, you know, a city, a rural area. I'm kind of glad I wasn't in Saigon, and I'm kind of glad I was up country and doing construction work. I think when you keep soldiers busy 18 hours a day, and you know, take care of them. They don't have time to get in trouble. I would hate to have to be responsible for soldiers in Cameron Bay, because in Saigon, because there's too many ways you could get in trouble.
Personal relationships. Did you? I know that you've got some people that you've been friends with since your 26 years, and have stayed friends with them since then. Did you have any friends in Vietnam that you still keep in contact with? Was it a bonding experience, or did you try and stay aloof of others?
No, you go through hardship with people, and you get to know them, and they become friends. I would say that as you move all over the country, that you have maybe 100 to 200 people after you retire that you send Christmas cards to. Ironically, it's the geographical location where you run into people again. Tom Smith, who was a major S1 of the group in Vietnam, and he was like 2 tents down from me when we were across the bay from Cameron, got out of the Army after 10 years. He was a Corps of Engineer officer. And when I was the district engineer in St. Paul, Tom Smith, as an engineer, worked for this quarry rock company. And so we got reunited. And then when I retired and come to Arizona about 10 years ago, we were in the church and turn around, and there's Tom Smith sitting in the church with his wife, and they had moved to Arizona. And so we see them on a regular basis, and here's somebody that was in Vietnam with us. And so there's a friendship that traveled. Now, the friendship wouldn't have stayed in place unless geographically we got back together. I met a officer when I was at Battalion Command School, Fort Knox, 20-some years ago, Clem Clements in the Ordnance Corps. And he lives out here near us, and we're good friends. And I met another officer as a young major who was an MP officer, and now he lives in the area here. So I think to keep the friendship going, you meet them, you like them, but if you don't get geographically located together, you can't continue to nurture the friendship and stay in contact. But friendship's one of these things you have to spend time with people to stay friends with them. And most of us are fortunate to have a half a dozen true friends, but we do know a lot of people. But I think the military, one of the great benefits is there's a lot of comradeship and you meet a lot of nice people.
Now, when you lived in the camps, was there anything that kind of sticks out in your mind as kind of humorous or funny? And again, it probably wasn't meant at the time, but as you reflect on it.
Yeah, the one incident that I remember is when we went into Vung Ro Bay and we were in it and we were living in this tent. And the only bathroom at the time, because we just got there, was a one-holer, one-hole toilet with no roof or no walls, sitting out on a stretch of beach. And what they would do is, you were eating sea rations, this 10-in-1 sea rations, and they tend to make you constipated. And then every week they would give you the malaria pill, which tend to give you diarrhea. So we always joke about being stopped up and then blown out. But I can remember about my first or second week in country, in the middle of the night, it's raining like mad, and I have these great stomach pains. Well, we're about, after the break here, we're back to this incident with these stomach pains, and it's raining, and I said, well, I'm going to have to make a run out to the one holer. There's no roof on this thing, so probably the thing to do is to strip off naked, be in the nude, and make a run for it. And I did that, and I tripped over the rope to the tent as I ran out. And then I ran, and then I fell down again. By the time I got to the one holer, I didn't need to be there, but I was filthy, and so I decided, well, since I'm already wet, I'll go back and get a bar of soap and wash off and take a shower. So I got my soap, and I'm standing outside the tent, and I'm cleaning myself up when the roving guard called and challenged me. And I can remember giving the call signs and talking to him, but what flashed through my mind, I've been in country a week, and I get shot in the nude while taking a shower by a friendly American guard. But I think those kind of incidences happen and you laugh about. I remember at Cameron Bay, I was using a four-holer one night, and you go in and they got the big 55-gallon drum under the hole. And I thought to myself, I wonder if there's any spiders in this. So I lit a piece of toilet paper and I checked down in the hole and there wasn't any spiders. So I dropped the toilet paper and sit down. And then I felt the heat because the diesel started burning. And I didn't want to be known as the major that burned down the shit house. So I ran around and grabbed a hook and pulled the 55-gallon drum with diesel fuel in it. And so we built and burnt the poop early that night. But those kind of things, when you're off in war, they happen. And in retrospect, they're funny. But I'm sure there's a million humorous stories that came out of Vietnam.
As the S3, why didn't you just have somebody build your own personal latrine?
Well, one thing that you try to do is you have missions to build a lot of things for a lot of people. And I can remember our first job in country. We went over and we were going to build a replacement center that would process soldiers in and out country. And this was over on Cameron Bay. And we had our people, a company of construction folks in tents, and we were building this replacement center. And the old colonel at the time, Colonel Starnes, come over and says, the first thing you learn is the first week you build up your own base camp so that your people are living halfway decently, and then you build this facility, and in total you'll get it done quicker and better. So that was one case where we took care of ourselves first before we took care of the customer. But engineer units that have the capability to build and maintain things that support themselves shouldn't live any better than the people they support. So I think you really have to be careful. And we always try to give our customers as good treatment as we give ourselves.
Now, when you left Vietnam, looking back on as you were leaving, how did you feel about it?
Well, it's funny that the 12-month rotation is you feel that you're doing your duty and you start getting to be a short timer. And you get to be a short timer when you got about 30 days to go. And short timers pick up certain superstitions or things. And one is, you know, you don't want to get killed your last day in country. You know, you always hear about the person that served 364 days and got shot. So what happens when you get near the end, the only thing you want to do is successfully complete your tour and get out of there alive. And one of the things that short-timers hate to do is to be given an assignment where you go off and ride the helicopter. And so engineer officers don't want to ride the helicopter when they're short-timers. I guess I felt that I had a successful year, and I felt very proud of what I did. I think I got promoted in country from captain to major, and I was in my eighth year of service, so I was a young major. But I think there was a certain confidence that serving in combat a year and proving that what you do is the right thing to do, and that you get good work ethics and you make good judgments, and that your leadership principles work. So I guess I felt pretty good about myself. In fact, I felt very good about myself. Surprisingly, I was the ranking person on the airplane that flew out that day from Cameron Bay. And the joy of all the soldiers and everybody on that airplane is that, gosh, we made it, we're going home. And I can remember the stewardess on the plane making the comment of that there's no smoking on this airplane because smoking is bad for your health. And here is a bunch of people that just went through a year of things that were very bad for your health, and how big a laugh that got. But on the airplane, you got your steaks and you got treated nice. And as we landed at Travis Air Force Base, being the plane commander, I was the first off of the plane, and I came down the chute. And the TV crowd sitting there, there's reporters with microphones and the TV cameras running. And I was kind of shocked at the questions they were asking, which was a bunch of negative questions, like they were digging for dirt about Vietnam. And this was in September of 1970, We went over there in 66, or it had to be 67. And so in 67, and I didn't realize the attitude of the press and the people had changed the year I was in country, Vietnam, about the war. And that was because in my letters back and forth from home, Janie didn't talk about the press and what they were saying about the war. And I wasn't talking about what we were doing in the war. So our letters really didn't convey those, the political aspect. But I was kind of disappointed coming home and finding the attitude towards the war changed to a negative thing. Here I was, proud of my service. I came home and I felt like people here didn't appreciate what you did.
So you look at it as a positive experience for you. Do you think it as a whole was a positive experience?
Absolutely. When I see the movies that they made about Vietnam, I keep thinking, this must be a different war than the one I went through. We went over to help build the infrastructure of South Vietnam and help the people in Vietnam and stop the spread of communism. And we thought we were doing what was right and we did it well. And I came home. I was a better officer when I came home. I was better trained. And I think maybe all the training that officers like myself got in Vietnam really paid dividend in the Gulf War. I thought we did so well in that Gulf War because I think there was a lot of positive lessons learned from Vietnam. And so my memories of Vietnam are very positive, not negative.
You did a lot of construction work that year, and you now do that as a professor, of construction engineering. So do you think your year in Vietnam helped you grow in your career, not only in the military, but afterwards as well?
Oh, absolutely. I can remember one incident where, as a major at Cameron Bay, this colonel came in and says, we're going to do an airfield up in the highlands, and Major, come with me. And so we got in a helicopter, and we flew up to the highlands and landed by a mountainard village. And the colonel says, in 29 days, the 101st is going to have an airborne operation into this area, and we're going to need an airfield right along here. And I turned to him and I says, well, what size airfield do you want? How long? And I can remember the old colonel looking at me and said, hell, you're the engineer, and walked away. And I turned to the pilot and asked him if he could tell me which direction the prevailing wind comes. And he says, over that mountain or village towards us. And then I asked him, how long is most airfields? And he said, 3,500 feet. And I said, how wide? And he said, 80. So I had three pieces of information to build the airfield on. And then I'm standing out there in this field, and I'm pacing off and sighting over my thumb and writing on the back of an envelope. And I realize that most engineers, when they get ready to design and build something, they're not given all the parameters, and they have to go out and make assumptions and figure this all out. And I did, and we did, and 29 days later, there was an airfield there, and so forth. So you become an engineer, but what you realize is that it's not like in school where the professor gives the students six of the seven parameters and you solve for the seventh parameter. That as an engineer, you have to find out what parameters you're looking for, and you have to figure out what they are, and you have to find out what answer to work from. So it's the whole process of being an engineer or a constructor, and the whole process of educating students, and I think it's really shaped how I educate my students in my school. And that being an engineer or a constructor, it's more important that one is that you're the captain of your own ship, that you're in charge. And so I have a quote or a saying I give my students: you're hired for your technical skills, but you're fired for your lack of people skills, and you're promoted for your leadership and management skills. So we have our students work in teams, so they develop leadership and people skills. We do a lot of having them stand up and speak and talk, and we make them do a lot of writing so their communication's there, and we make every student do a leadership and management paper. I think my sensitivity to how important it is for professionals to have leadership and management, that philosophy and that recognition, well, was honed during my time in Vietnam and my military service. So leadership and people skills to me are so much more important than they were prior to my military service or prior to my Vietnam time.
Since it was such a positive experience for you, was it astonishing to you or amazing to you to see like people like Jane Fonda and these people who were so anti-Vietnam and anti-everything that you had done and fought for?
Well, you know, Jane Fonda turned me off so much that I never watch one of her movies, or if she is on TV or Hillary or Bill Clinton is on TV, I turn them off. My vote is I'm not going to listen to these people. I thought Jane Fonda used the war as a vehicle for personal recognition. She was looking to become known. And I think the feeling towards the Jane Fondas of the world by the soldiers that I served with was so negative. My feeling is that it was their chance to show people how smart or how cute or how difficult they can be. And so I'm definitely not a Jane Fonda fan. I think that in our society, when we have instant communications, people take advantage of trying to be in the spotlight. And I think she definitely took the advantage to be in the spotlight. And I don't think her motives were so noble. I think her seeking the publicity was what she was doing.
That's pretty much all I have, Dr. Badger, if you'd like to say anything else.
Well, you know, in a couple of the questions you asked me about weapons that the Viet Cong had that would help them in being successful against us. And I'll give that a lot of thought. I think the best weapon that the Vietnamese had, the VC had, was the liberal press in the United States. Because I think we were very successful in our effort until the liberal press turned the support of the American people against the military and against being successful. So the best weapon that the VC had was our liberal press. Then I looked and said, well, what's the next best weapon and what did they do that was so smart? And then I thought making drugs readily available to the American troops in the 68, 69, 70 time frame was probably their next best weapon, because with those two weapons, it was, you know, time was on their side. And probably the third best weapon that VC had was time. The longer we were going to be there, the less popular the war was going to be. So the liberal press changing the attitude of people towards Vietnam, the drugs that was provided for our soldiers in country, and time dragging it on out, all those three weapons worked in the favor of the VC and against American troops.
Okay, thank you.